Welcome to Healthcare Rounds. I'm your host, John Marchica, CEO of Darwin Research Group and faculty associate at Arizona State University. Here we explore the vast and rapidly evolving healthcare ecosystem with leaders across the spectrum of healthcare delivery. Our goal is to promote ideas that advance the quadruple aim, including improving the patient experience, improving the health of populations, lowering the cost of care, and attaining joy in work. Please send your questions, comments, or ideas for Healthcare Rounds to podcast@darwinresearch.com. And if you like what you hear, please don't forget to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Let's get started.
Theo Bader, CEO and co-founder of Trialjectory, is a savvy and experienced entrepreneur with decades of experience in business development, product marketing, and strategy. Prior to co-founding Trialjectory, Svia headed the global business unit at Amdocs, where she was responsible for building a new product growth strategy, as well as for global sales and marketing. Svia has held different business development and marketing positions in several tech companies, both B2B and B2C. She holds a Master of Science degree from the University of Nottingham in Nottingham, UK.
So, Svia, by now, through the magic of podcasting and recording, as I say in some form or another at the beginning of these things, we will have read in your bio. Kim will probably have read in your bio, but a bio is a bio. So I want to hear in your words, tell me a little bit about your background before we get to your company.
Of course. So I'm originally from Israel. I moved to the US 15 years ago. And my entire career is in high tech, so software development, but really around taking advantage in technology and seeing what can be done with them. So started with telecommunication industry, banking industry, then call center industry, trying to make all of those more better and more digitalized in a lot of ways. And then I've decided that I'm done with the big corporates and I want to try the entrepreneurship side of the world.
Yes,
you're familiar with that.
I'm very familiar with that bug.
So my first startup was taking basically the same technology that we use for identifying fraud in call center, very similar at least, and applying it to identify fake news in social media. So still a very hot topic. That was 11 years ago, though. It was already a big problem, but it was a first lesson in entrepreneurship. Someone needs to care enough to pay you for what you're solving.
Yeah,
so that wasn't the case then. Nobody cared. Not sure they care that much today either. Let's be honest about it. From there, I joined the team that started. I joined the founder of Talkspace, which I'm sure a lot of people on here might be familiar with by now. We wanted to remove barriers for mental health, and that became obviously a very needed solution. Definitely during the time of COVID. So that's kind of my professional bio. I have 3 girls, 2 dogs, and a cat. I live in New Jersey, just outside of Manhattan. And 7 years ago, I got diagnosed with cancer, and that's kind of what led me into the healthcare space.
Well, we're going to talk about that. I just want to do a quick detour, non-healthcare question, because you brought it up. Can technology solve this fake news issue that we have that's such a problem these days?
I think it can help solve it. Yeah, absolutely. I think at the end of the day, there is enough tools and capability that exist to validate the sources. And you know, the same way, if you think about other organizations, maybe on the security sides that are validating sources and checking for reliability, a lot of it is done automatically today. Same can be applied to some degree. It's never 100%, but definitely better than what it is today. To the social media, you can identify where the origin of the information is, how many sources there is, the timestamp, and then correlate it and see if it makes sense or doesn't make sense, and flag things that doesn't make sense. But someone needs to want it, and someone needs to be willing to invest in it. And unfortunately, right now, the social media company don't feel like they're responsible all the way to what's being posted there. And the government is trying to force them, but like not putting it completely on their shoulders in terms of responsibility. So it's a big question is who owns and who's responsible for the content being published on social media outlets.
Is the issue, and then we are going to get to your topic, but since you have a background in this area, I'm interested, is the issue that more angry or salacious will say postings go viral faster and keep people engaged longer, and therefore there's no incentive for a Facebook or Twitter to want to put these kinds of controls in place?
In my opinion, completely, yeah. The more provocative, noisy you are, the more emotional are attached to a topic, the more attention it grabs. So the more time we spend on those social media, right? We go back to that, we respond to that, others respond, and in fact, it exactly creates that type of dialogue that is not healthy for us as a society, but extremely beneficial for those who are running those platforms.
Yeah, yeah.
Unfortunately, it's like taking all of our, I think, shortage as human beings and putting them at the front center.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. So talk to me about, we talked in the pre-interview a little bit about your journey, but talk to me about what you went through as much as you're comfortable when you with cancer, and then how that led to Trialjectory.
Sure. So when I got diagnosed with cancer, you know, I had three little girls at home. It wasn't my first time knowing cancer. I lost my mom to cancer. But because I was part of what we call the digital revolution, right? The digitalization of everything, the democratization of access to information. I was really naive. I was like, okay, so I got the C word. It's not fun. Let me go online. Let me check out my option. Based on that, I'll make a decision. Where do I want to get treated? I'll choose my treatment and I'll move on. See, I was expecting a more or less seamless experience. That's how naive and idiotic I was at the time. So I went online, and what I found is that internet froze at that 1.0, the generation. We talk about web 3.0 for in the healthcare, it's still 1.0, meaning there's a lot of content out there, but there, none of it is personalized. None of it is actionable. So you can read a lot, you can get scared a lot, you can get confused, but it doesn't really help you navigate through your journey or make any kind of relevant decision, which basically means that we're stuck at the same place we were always at. We are totally dependent from a patient point of view at the hand of the physician. So whatever the physician knows, wherever is being you're being treated, that's unfortunately determined outcome for you. And it's a scary thought. And it was extremely scary for me. So I think you got a grip of who I am, right? I'm a high tech executive. I'm high speed. I want to own my journey. I want to make decisions. I'm quick to, and then all of a sudden I'm losing all control over my life. I'm dealing with this disease. I'm reading information that really, let's be honest, I didn't really even understand the words they were using to describe and some of the key terms. I'm sitting in front of physicians. They talk quickly. They don't give me any option, basically telling me what's going to happen. And I'm feeling at loss. So you start losing control, you sort of surrender and outsource. So I met this physician. He told me, I need to put you on a surgery. Go for the surgery. I go for the surgery. Then all of a sudden, it's not enough. Another one and another one. Then you need to meet an oncologist. I go meet him. He's telling me, I wait 3 hours to meet him. And you sit there again. You have nothing to say. You sort of like, okay, my life is not in my hands. I need to do what I'm being told, which was never a good, you know, never one of my best characteristics to do what I'm being told.
Yeah, you don't seem like the kind of person.
Exactly. Even when I was like serving the army, that was not my strongest point. Let me tell you that. So I was waiting there and I met with this oncologist. He spent total 5 minutes with me, doesn't know me, doesn't know anything about who I am. And basically takes one look at my measurement at the papers and tell me, well, you're not doing too well. We need to see if it didn't metastasize to the brain. Maybe I have one clinical trial for you. Let me see. Come back after a brain MRI and we'll talk then and get out of. And he's rushing out of the room. And you sort of sit there and say, that was my waking moment. Excuse me? Like, what? Not doing too well, I get it. Okay, fair enough. But what do you mean one? And why clinical trial? And what's the outcome? What are my options? And for me, that was the point that I realized he couldn't care less about me. He doesn't know that I need to leave. I have three, you know, my youngest daughter was one at the time. That I have every intention of giving it all to win over it. He doesn't know me and basically he's not even making an effort. And looking at him, I was thinking, how does he know all of the option? Like, who made him God or Wiki or Wikipedia in a way? Like, he didn't have any tools in his that he looked at to sort of search treatment option. So the whole thing did not work well, in my opinion, at that point in time. And I was looking at my husband, I was just like, here, I'm not staying. And he looked at me and said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, I don't know. I don't have that part figured out yet, but I'll figure it out. And that's, I think, was my first moment of realizing, okay, I need to do something different. So I'm lucky. I live by a big city, by large research institution. So I relocated my case. I met a better oncologist, in my opinion, at least. He gave me three options. I felt, ooh, top of the world. So I started the first clinical trial I was at. 8 months through it, that wasn't good enough. My cancer came back. I then started another standard of care. Bottom line, my entire journey was like 8 surgeries, I think 4 or 3 approved drugs and 3 clinical trials. But what was important in it, I know, healthy. But I did the trick, right? I'm here, I'm alive and kicking ass. But throughout it, I was like continuously reminded that I need to be sure that I'm making the right decision for me. Because even at the best hospital that I went to, at a certain point after the first clinical trial failed, I asked my oncologist a simple question. I asked, are you offering me what's best out there for me? Or are you offering me the best at this hospital and I'm supposed to now shop around? And he answered very truthfully. He said, not only I can only offer you what's here, only what's here and I'm aware of. So he was honest about it. Mm. Which is fair enough. It's a good answer, but it's not good enough for me, right? How do I make sure that I get the best out of everything out there?
Sure.
How do I make sure that at least I know what's out there? So that's kind of my story.
Did you end up with these subsequent trials? Did you end up going to different institutions?
So I'm lucky enough that I managed to get not having to go to a different institution because I ended up either in this same hospital finding trials that my oncologist was not aware of, or basically helping them get another seat for me at a trial that they didn't have any seat for, were not planning. Because let's be honest, even the hospital, if they have a good candidate, it's a good revenue source for them, clinical trials. So it's not something they object of doing. But there was a lot of dialogue, not only about finding the trials, also which one is right for you. I can share with you the last trial that actually did the trick for me. It's an interesting one in terms of understanding patient preference, okay? When I went back to my oncologist with this trial that I found and asked him, what does he think about it? And he was just like, this is very aggressive treatment. I'm not sure it's right for you right now. Maybe we should keep it as a last resort if we do something else now. And then if it doesn't work, you can always go back to that. It's very aggressive. And then I consulted with another oncologist from a different hospital and was just like, it's very aggressive. So you seem very strong. So you have why not take something aggressive and give it a fair chance in beating it at this point in time? And then you sort of like, okay, so it goes back to you as a personality. Are you strong enough to handle something aggressive? Do you have the backup you need at home to go through a more aggressive treatment that will basically will probably not make you available to take care of everything else in life and keep the balance of work and life and the rest of it. So there's a lot of personal attributes and life that comes into play also when you choose a treatment. And I've decided, against my oncologist recommendation, I decided that I'm strong enough now to go through something like that. I don't know if I'll be strong enough later. And I'm a tough cookie, so I'd rather give it all I've got and see where it lands.
Was that your third trial?
That was my third and most successful so far.
Wow. Well, we talked a lot about in our pre-interview about patient-centered care. And I went to and looked at the Institute of Medicine and how they defined it. And they say it's providing care that is respectful of and responsive to individual patient preferences, needs and values, and ensuring that patient values guide all clinical decisions. That doesn't sound like what you were receiving.
Exactly. Unfortunately not. And not what majority of patients are receiving. I don't think the dialogue usually even takes place from my experience and what I'm hearing from patients, the dialogue or the option. of what's available, of understanding the patient characteristic and what he's looking for. Even from a medical perspective, a lot of the time, especially when we talk about cancer care and the trends towards precision medicine, there is a lot of new treatment that are looking, you know, at specific biomarker, at specific capability. Those even not take care, not that those dialogue doesn't take place. A lot of the time, physicians decide not to even test patients for NGS testing because they think that there is a standard of care, and only if it fails, they'll go and test for genetic testing, or if they found like mutation. I heard from one patient that is a KRAS, that lung cancer with KRAS, that his oncologist told them, there's no targeted drugs for KRAS now. Let's start with the chemo and see where that leads us. So there's nothing that is close to truly putting patient needs and values and preference at the center is unfortunately taking place in the real life right now.
Well, there's a whole field of study in this area. I went back to work on a PhD later in life, and actually my advisor, but it was really a multidisciplinary program in healthcare, but this was patient-centered decision-making, was one quarter about of the degree. And she was an expert in this area. We talked a little bit about that in the pre-interview. So it's not like there hasn't been research, loads of research done that shows better outcomes when patients are well-informed and appropriately informed. And honestly, I talk to a lot of healthcare executives, and this patient centricity goes by a bunch of different names, but they all say that that's what they're implementing, right? That's what their focus is. Often the strategic priorities of their organization is to put those patient preferences first and have patient-oriented care. So tell me about, because I know we're going to get to it sooner or later, tell me about TrialJectory, how you went from being a very frustrated patient and come up with what you're doing today, and tell me about the platform.
Absolutely. So basically, I agree with you. There's a lot of good intention out there from the hospitals all the way to pharmaceutical companies, but I think the gaps are still wide, and the gaps are wide, and because there's a lot of data around patients that are not taking place, and there's a lot of need on the patient side, tools for them to find their voice and be more active. It has to be. It's a two-way road, right? It can't be just at the hospital or the pharmaceutical doing something and the patient is still at the same place. So TrialJectory, as you said, came out of my own frustration. It was clear to me that in order to empower patients, in order to activate them, in order to make them being able to voice their preference and have this dialogue with their physician and drive data to the decision the pharma are doing, we need to help them own their journey in a better way. And the only way to really do it, in my opinion, obviously coming from my background, is leveraging technology. Because I think otherwise, you know, there's a lot of advocacy groups, et cetera, but it's not scalable and it's not in real time and it doesn't help empowering at the individual level. So what we did in TrialJectory, or doing in TrialJectory, basically we took artificial intelligence engine, and that's what we've built to basically do the initial matching between a patient and a treatment. We felt that if this bottleneck will be resolved, it's the first starting point, right? So we build this AI machine that reads through the treatment protocol and let a patient comes in, build his profile, tell us about his journey, tell us about his medical profile, tell us about what he's going through, and then we help match him to the treatment option. So out of the gate, instead of going to Dr. Google and getting lost, it's like not being dependent on what just his physician knows, he can get online in 5 minutes, find all treatment options that are relevant for him. And that's immediately empower you. Then you see your options. So it's a good starting point. Now I know my option. The other thing that we do with this engine is we also curate it for patient-friendly language. Remember what I told you about my feeling of like even sitting there, not even understanding the term. So we simplify it to the patient language so we can understand what treatment it is, how it's giving, answering key patient question. And from that starting point, now we can start having the dialogue with his physician. Now we can start asking him about this treatment versus this treatment. And they can start engaging and making the right decision for him. More than that, we also take data that we collect from patient and from the protocols and the research, around how other patients have experienced specific treatment, what side effect they experience. So we also leverage the community power and push it back to the patient. But again, in a very personalized manner, it's not about accumulated data. Because as a cancer patient, I don't care about all breast cancer patients, right? I need to know about breast cancer patient with the same subtype as mine, the same stage as mine, and the same biomarkers as mine. Only then the data become relevant. So that's exactly what we do. So we personalize treatment option and data around the treatment option to really empower the patient to start navigating their journey.
So what is, I'm not asking you for the secret sauce, but I'm just curious, is it working through like NCCN guidelines or some other kind of pathway? Like how is it able to determine that? And then this is kind of a two-parter. Once you do get that information, however you get it, and I'm curious to know how, are they getting something that then they can take to their doctor, or are they getting clinical trials? Are they getting existing drugs that are recommended for the treatment or surgery? Like, what is it? I'm trying to envision what the deliverable is.
So first of all, yes. So we go through, we want to show them all their options. We actually started with clinical trials and now we're incorporating standard of care approved drugs. So we take it from clinicaltrials.gov where the treatment protocols are there. Mm-hmm. When we have a relationship with the pharmaceutical company, we get the full protocols from the pharmaceutical company. We look at PEBMAP, so all the publication of the drugs approval, what was in the study, what profiles of patient were tested, what was the outcome. And we also look at the NCCN guidelines. And what they're getting is exactly what you indicated, a personalized list of clinical trials that match their profile, also approved drugs that for their specific drug profile, and they can then share it with their oncologist or take it to a second opinion if they want. We try and we with time, we continuously add more data points into it. So if it's phase 3 trial, we're now going to incorporate what was their outcome in phase 2. So we try to incorporate more and more data points so they can have more information in their possession for that dialogue. We're not trying to replace the oncologist. That needs to be clear. I don't think technology, if you think about any occupation in the world, Zillow did not replace the realtor, right?
Right.
Kayak did not replace travel agency. Everybody still exists. But the idea is that you have more information in order to make better decisions. So the same idea here. We let them share that information with their oncologist. And we've seen amazing cases where they came to their oncologist. Let's say we had this breast cancer recurrence. And she came to our oncologist. And she was really frustrated and worried because she didn't want to go into chemo again because she felt like it didn't help the first time. What's going to make be a difference? And she found a trial that was a combination of immunotherapy with chemo. And she went to her oncologist the day she was supposed to start the chemo with a trial option. He looked at it and basically told her, you know what, that makes a lot of sense. And I've seen and I've heard about where a combination of chemo with immunotherapy had better results. I suggest that we will explore it. Or we had another patient that, you know, just got her results that they're met as a result of lung cancer. They wasn't sure what the option going to be. They came into the platform, they shared the result. They met with the oncologist and she said when she came over, he already had notes over the emails she shared with the result with him. And he said, listen, this trial is actually run by a friend of mine. I called him. He's going to meet with you later today. So it helps remove the barriers in communication, remove the barriers in information access. And by that, help everybody get better treatments and hopefully better outcome.
Do you run into problems with physicians who are naturally skeptical? Somebody comes in, they show, you know, a printout of something that they got from a website. In other words, do you find that you get pushback from that? Or is it presented in such a way that physicians understand that what they're looking at is as free from bias as possible?
So there are a few that push back. There's always those, but I can tell you that it's less than we expected. Majority of the physician, because of the way it's presented, because when they look at it, they see the validity of the result. We spend a lot of time QAing the system because AI, like anything else, you know, needs to be trained and corrected.
Right, of course.
Better with time. So we have a team of actually really smart PhDs and cancer researchers that what they do is correct and auto-correct the machine to get to the level of accuracy we need it to be. So when they spend a minute and actually look at that, majority of them embrace it. And we have really amazing use cases of physicians actually referring other patients to us and actually asking, how can I give more of my patient access to this? How can I use you more often in a more seamless way? Because I see the value of that for my patient, which is what you want for. And then also, I got to tell you, I'm okay with if a physician and a patient sit on the list and together agree that it's not right. And what the original plan is still the better plan. It's awesome. Then you made a choice out of option rather than
right.
as a default. You step, and I look, physician today have what, 5 to 7 minutes per patient? It's crazy. So it's not like they have time to plan or investigate and think about the patient before they meet him. That's why usually they'll stick to the familiar standard of care. But the mere fact that we force them to stop for a second, rethink the strategy, and then choose whatever strategy is best, that's the best of outcome we can expect for, right?
Exactly. Well, you mentioned entrepreneurship in the beginning. I can't figure out your business model. So who do you view as your, other than the patient, obviously, who do you view as your customer?
So we look at ourselves as a three-leg platform. We have the patient that we serve. We have the physician that we serve, and now more and more of them we serve. And then we have the pharmaceutical company who are our paying customer. And the way we work with the pharmaceutical company, because you start by talking about what we talk about in terms of patient centricity, and the same kind of patient centricity is needed on the pharmaceutical side as well, right? They want to become more patient-centric.
Yep.
They know that patients are now driving more decisions, so they need to educate the patient directly and not just be a physician as they've done before. They're looking for patients for their clinical trials, and they're behind because they can't reach the right patient. And they need to start planning programs that are more suitable for patients, because if they come up with a drug with side effect that no patient is willing to tolerate, it's not going to be successful, right? If they design a clinical trials that require a patient, and we've seen those, to come to the hospital five times a week just for a blood work, that's not going to happen anymore because the patient has option. This is not going to be their first option, right? So they want to become more patient-centric. And what we let them is exactly achieve that. We, on the one hand, give patient access to their treatment, right? Expose them treatment. And if we have a relationship with them, we can give more information around for patient who match. We can give them more information, educate them better around the logic, about the trials, about the programs, about the drugs, whatever it is. And on the other hand, we take the analytic, we take our platform, and we provide the pharmaceutical company with what I believe is the first patient-centric analytic data dashboard. Because we take the patient data, both from medical to geographic location, to travel preference, to barriers, to motivation, to competitive viewpoint, and we share it with the pharmaceutical. So now they can understand what the patient is worried about, or is concerned, or his oncologist. Why? What treatment did he choose over theirs, and why? What did he prefer? What's important to him? What's the competitive landscape look like? Not because two pharmaceutical companies are developing the same targeted drugs for the same mutation, but from a patient point of view, there's actually other options that he might consider. And there's something that drives him towards one versus the other. And this information is critical for them to truly become patient-centric, right? How can you become patient-centric without having data around patients? Think about the consumer market. So that's exactly what we offer to pharma. And so it's a win-win.
It's a win-win. Well, it's a fascinating business. And I appreciate your taking the time to speak with me today. So just to kind of wrap things up, we do have a broad mix of listeners, which would include pharma, as well as health system executives. Probably a lot of them are involved in the cancer space. So just want to give you a chance to offer some of your final thoughts that you might want to share.
So I think the time has come. You started by saying, patient centricity as a concept of patient-focused care has been around for a long time, but we never really materialized in it, right? We gave patient apps with better access to their medical records. So it's a good start, but the patient doesn't know what to do with it, right? You run surveys around patient satisfaction. It's a starting point, but what does it tell you really about a patient? And how do you really give the patient the tool to own his journey? And I think the time has come. If you think about COVID changed the world in a lot of ways. It's also changed us as patients. we now own our journey. We go test when we want to get tests. We actually test ourselves. We take our vaccine. The world is not so patient, even though they were afraid, realize they need to own now their journey. So now it's the time to give them the tool to not just educate themselves, but really to find, to become true partners in the decision-making. And I think decision support platform for patients are critical. So, and amending your programs and the way you operate to really understand the patient's need, their barriers, their concerns is critical for the success of any organization these days. So whether it's via our platform, others' platform, those programs of patient centricity needs a really awakening and significant change to really be impactful in this new world.
Well, I go back to what you started off talking about, the journey, Tzvi. And that is, you know, I consider myself, I'm in this field. I've been in healthcare one way or the other my whole career. And now with what we're doing here, constantly researching different therapeutic areas, different systems of care, health policy. I mean, I'm kind of like all over the board. And I feel like when we go into a new area that I have the background to be able to understand these things. But I'm like, my particular career path has led me to where I am. The average person who gets a diagnosis like cancer, and I hope that I never see that diagnosis, but the average person doesn't understand not only what they're being told or when they're going to these various websites. There's a lot of kind of like what we're talking about with the social, you know, there's a lot of misinformation. How do you know? Like, I know that if I'm in New England Journal of Medicine, for example, I know that what I'm reading has been vetted, has been peer reviewed, and it's a top medical journal. And I feel like I can trust most of, you know, what I read. But your average consumer, number one, doesn't know that. Number two, probably isn't going to stumble across the New England Journal of Medicine when they're trying to find out, right?
Right. So you will stumble around and not the best. Lots of ads by the pharmaceutical company, by the healthcare system, statistically competing or offering one treatment for him, presenting as the best for him. That's what he's going to stumble upon, not even realizing that it's an advertisement.
Right. So my big takeaway is, you know, when we're thinking about patient-centered care, a lot of times that's when kind of on the back end or when care is being delivered. But the important distinction here for me is patient choice and helping informed patient choice and informed patient decision-making is what you're empowering people with. And I as I said, it's a fascinating company. I appreciate your taking the time to speak with me today. And I think folks are really going to enjoy this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. And thank you again for the time spent and the dialogue.
You too.
From all of us at Darwin Research Group, thanks for listening. Healthcare Rounds is produced by me, Kim Ishudo, and is engineered by Andrew Rojek. Theme music by John Marchica. Darwin Research Group provides advanced market intelligence and in-depth customer insights to healthcare executives. Our strategic focus is on healthcare delivery systems and the global shift toward value-based care. Find us at darwinresearch.com. See you next round.